Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report podcast. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. And joining us today are Mackenzie Eaglin and Hallie Coyle of the American Enterprise Institute to discuss their report, the 2020s Tri-Service Modernization Crunch, an absolutely fascinating assessment of how the spending and modernization crunch is going to impact each of the military services, and interestingly, differently, including a very unique use of data that, Hallie, you had to extrapolate. So guys, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us on.
And I wanted to commend to our audience to check out the terrific conversation Mackenzie had last week with House Armed Services Committee Chairman Adam Smith. It was a terrific conversation for the insights included, but that's not why we're convening today. It's to talk about your tri-service report. And before we get started, our global coverage is sponsored by Leonardo DRS. Northrop Grumman sponsors our weekly cyber report and our cyber coverage overall. Fincantieri Marinette Marine sponsors our naval coverage. General Atomics Aeronautical Systems sponsors our coverage of strategy. General Motors Defense sponsors our coverage of technology. And Rafael Advanced Defense Systems sponsors our coverage of air and missile defense. Mackenzie, you know, we've been talking about the bow wave, the modernization bow wave. Obviously, spending is staying flat. Modernization plans have been always more ambitious than available funding. And yet, at the end of the day, we always manage to muddle through, although there's a sense that this time, right, business as usual is no longer going to work, in part because of a confluence of technology, but also financial limitations the nation has. And oh, by the way, the threat is very different, right? We're back to a great power competition mindset. What is making the modernization crunch from the modernization spending crunch this time around much worse and much different than anything in the past?
Well, as you said, it's a confluence of events where all of the services are arriving at this moment in time at roughly the same time, maybe a year or two off. And so, it's been coined the terrible 20s by Commander Salamander, which I would firmly endorse. And the challenge is, right, so as things have, you know, service lives have been extended, things that are old, and we're pushing the limits of aviation, you know, like the B-52, you know, that's fine. And you can keep doing that. But at the same time, there are some systems that are no longer capable of being upgraded or aren't worth it to be upgraded because they won't be of any value in a potential, you know, high-end fight. And so then you really have to make those hard decisions, those early trade-off choices sooner than the Pentagon has been willing to do, right? So Robert Gates wiped out a generation of modernization that the Budget Control Act then followed through. And then, you know, there was a hollow buildup during the wars. So here you have this moment, again, where you have systems like, take, for example, the ICBM, the ground-based leg of the nuclear deterrent. General Hyten and many other leaders have basically said, it's done. You cannot extend it anymore. You either buy the next one or you call it off. And you can see that across, if you go system by system, you can sort of see that trend following through.
Hallie, why don't you talk to us a little bit about the methodology you guys used, right? Because you're extrapolating forward the data over the past two budgets. Talk to us about how you guys did that to try to get to some sort of ground truth budgetarily.
Thanks for the question. We really saw a lot of value in trying to extrapolate forward, as you just said, right? So the DoD obviously releases five-year spending plans, usually for procurement and RDT&E via the FYDP. And so we pulled that for projecting the cost for the next 5 years. But after that, it gets a lot more complicated and you have to deal with much more uncertainty. But we're fairly confident in what we drew on and the sources that we accessed. So be that, you know, the aviation analysis that was conducted by the Congressional Budget Office, be that work from the Congressional Research Service, right? We drew on a lot of other expert analysis and pulled that together, including our own assessments of where a number of these programs are going in terms of where, you know, the bomber fleet is probably going, where tankers are probably going in the next 10 years, to pull together what we thought was, you know, a fair outline for what people should be looking at, especially over the longer term.
And why are there different kinds of crunches hitting each of the services, right? It's not exactly the same challenge. Each one of them are unique, right? For obvious reasons. But what are the different crunches that are hitting and why?
So I think a lot of it depends both on the history of the modernization efforts in each service and also in terms of what they're trying to modernize, right? So for example, if we start with the Navy, clearly you have extended shipbuilding plans. They have long lead times. We know generally what we've been trying to do for an exceptionally long time, and that's been helped by annual shipbuilding plans that are supported to Congress. I know we missed it last year, but we drew on the FY20 shipbuilding plan, for example. And so we can expect what we're seeing within the Navy. So in this case, we're looking at huge costs for the Columbia class, huge costs for the Virginia class over 10 years, right? You're looking at uncertainty in terms of small surface combatants. You're looking at another potential replacement for large surface combatants, right? We know what we're looking at, and we have for some time. In terms of the Air Force, for example, you're stuck in sort of more of a catch-22, right? A lot of it depends on when the replacements come on for these aircraft that they're interested in divesting, but might not be able to if they can't convince Congress. So that's something else to keep in mind. And then if you look at the Army, there's another conversation, right? In some ways, their track record was impressive. Core Reagan vehicle and helicopter fleets have proved remarkably durable and modular and relevant for a while, but attempts to replace significant platforms have been frustrated often, right? And so now you're looking at modernization programs that are centering around vehicle and utility and attack helicopter fleets, and they accelerate in the mid to late 20s on top of long range right. fires, et cetera, which, as we know, are, you know, in the news frequently. So hopefully that's a helpful rundown of why you need to think about the service crunches separately and why we tried to, while acknowledging that they all will impact each other, right? So when you're pulling more money towards shipbuilding, that's obviously going to squeeze the Air Force and the Army. So it's a balance.
Mackenzie, let me ask you, right? I mean, the Marine Corps falls into a little bit of a different category, right? They're modernizing, but they're sort of, right, how does the transformation, right? Because transformation, one man's transformation or one person's transformation is another's, you know, dodging or an opportunity to cut, right? How is all of this going to be impacting the Marine Corps that arguably has been embracing the most transformational vision of all the services?
Right. See, it's always tricky with the Marine Corps. I hate to even say anything about it because then the Marines come find me, right? But you know,
they're very good at that, and they love to fight their corner. So
yes, you know, it's like they're not even in the same league as the services, because they are the smallest service. They are, well, okay, putting aside Space Force, right. You know, they're a small service. They're nimble. They count on big Navy and even big Army and Air Force to hitch a ride to longevity of operations, you know, sustainment and logistics and everything else. So when, and I would argue you saw this reflected in Jim Mattis, as Secretary of Defense, he thought differently. The Marines don't have to think about dominance of particular capabilities or domains, to be totally frank. And so he used words that hadn't been, you know, sort of sensitized in DOD before, like lethality. Lethality is different from modernization. Lethality is more like kill chain. It's more sort of, you know, the last, you know, kinetic effect, I would argue. But modernization is a much broader term that applies. The Marines are going to be in bad shape if they march forward and no one's behind them. Like if big Navy can't figure out its own modernization bow wave and get it done, right? It won't matter how innovative the Marine Corps is, I guess, or it won't matter as much. And then to your second point, yeah, you got to cut to transform. And this is where Congress has not been a partner. But it's interesting that the Commandant in the Marine Corps and the Chief of Staff of the Air Force have really, you know, linked arms and, you know, they've spilled ink in two prominent publications pleading with Congress to let them do exactly that. And it's interesting that the Air Force is hitching, you know, their argument wagon to the Marine Corps, because General Berger is making some progress. I would argue we'll know a lot more about how much, though, this year, because now the rubber is going to hit the road for consequential decisions for Congress. They've been, I'd argue, deferential up until this point, because they've seen the Commandant leaning in and fresh ideas and thinking, you know, take goring sacred cows. But now we're going to actually see if Congress has the guts to follow through with it. I'm not sure he's going to get nearly as much as he thinks in 22 from Congress as he hopes. And again, this is a harbinger for the Air Force and eventually all of the services. there's a whole host of different things. You have to make those trade-off choices early. You have to cut to innovate and transform. You have to protect procurement. You cannot just bulge research and development and then not transition those into programs of record. Otherwise, you're just looking at another lost decade, for example.
Well, so how do we look at that, right? I mean, Commandant Berger has gotten a lot of pressure from the retired Marine community, sort of thinking like, hey, this is way too risky. We're the 9/11 force for the nation. We have to remain broadly distributed. We've got to maintain the counterinsurgency know-how, right? I mean, something that the Marine Corps brought the rest of the force, because at least Marines learn counterinsurgency warfare, which the Army had, except for, you know, obviously the special operators would study that, but the rest of the force wasn't as focused on that when we got to Iraq and Afghanistan. One of the reasons why people push for more money is a fundamental unwillingness to make those trade-offs, Mackenzie. For each Adam Smith who says, hey, look, I backed getting rid of the B-2 bomber, even though a lot of it was made in my district in Washington, there are other members who refuse to make those sorts of trade-offs, right? I mean, so it's about either kill somebody else's program, rob Peter to pay Paul, or just spend more money to do it. We don't have spending more money. We understand we're in an inflection point. You talk to members of Congress a lot. Is there any willingness or understanding that, like, not every program is going to succeed and some will be more important than others and others may have to be sacrificed to pave the way for future capability?
I agree.
And how do we how do you do it?
Right. So I can see the argument that the commandant's putting all his eggs in one sort of type of basket and why Congress would not get fully behind that, because they are the lowest risk tolerant people, right? So, you know, I'd argue risk is an issue, sort of, it's different in the stakeholder community and who approaches it differently. But you're getting at part of the challenge, because it's like this interconnected web. And so just tackling one component of it will not totally help solve the problem. It'll buy you another year. It'll help with the muddle through, right? But you're not going to see the kinds of revolutionary change where we can catch up and or outpace China in certain capabilities and domains if we don't take on the whole web. And so what do I mean by that? For example, right, to your point on Congress and their reticence, right? They'd rather the bird in the hand every single time. And if you read what they write in the report language of their bills, they explain why they are that way. And they talk about the combatant commanders, right? So they are sensitive to what they see are insatiable demand signals from the combatant commanders and the services' right. inability to meet them as those who are, you know, the man, train, and equip force that are supposed to help meet those demands. So that's why I think, you know, and so the service chiefs recognize that part of their problem is also in that demand signal from the combatant commanders. And you have to tackle it all. And then behind the scenes, you know, you got to do the back end, the financial systems reform and the appropriations process reform and all the other things too. Like, you know, software shouldn't be a program of record. It shouldn't have specific line items, especially if it's multi-service. There's a lot of other little things. And so it takes somebody who really knows and understands the whole problem, knows and understands the building, has good relationships on the Hill. This unicorn doesn't exist. So yeah, but what we're trying to do is at least lay out the problem so that the stakeholders in DOD and on Capitol Hill in particular start to even acknowledge it. I'd argue the last group to wake up to this is the combatant commanders. They're still whistling past the graveyard. They have no idea what the services are wrestling with, particularly the chiefs. And we're just trying to, you know, bring shed some sunlight on this problem to all of those stakeholders.
There is an optimism among some that Secretary Auster and Dr. Hicks, as the deputy, Mike McCord, will be able to help navigate this as people who are both politically savvy and have made clear that tough decisions will have to be made. And several people have told me, right, that the president himself gets it, that we're going to have to make these trade-offs, but it means expending political energy, right? And so if you want an infrastructure measure, what horse trading might you have to do on other parts of the budget at the end of the day that become problematic. Hallie, I want to bring you in here, right? I mean, what are the things that have to happen in the near, mid, and long term to address these crunches which have become, right? I mean, there was a little bit of extra money from the White House, whether it was for inflation, but also for climate and other expenses, right? To try to make the defense budget a little more whole. From your standpoint, Hallie, what has to happen sort of near, mid, long-term to mitigate this crunch, these crunches?
So I think in the short term, you know, first and foremost, we need to, as Mackenzie said, reinforce how substantial these challenges are, right? That means that there needs to be buy-in from Congress. The next 5 years that are going to be essential for addressing a number of these crunches, and the strategic environment certainly is going to, I think, impose that imperative upon lawmakers and upon, you know, the building itself to have these conversations and to have those conversations between service chiefs, between the combatant commanders. And I think there is motivation to do so, or I hope that some of it is, you know, gaining traction. Second, I think that in terms of talking about the defense budget top line, and in terms of addressing, you know, these other interests that are making their way towards the defense budget or into the defense budget, be it climate change, be it COVID response, et cetera, those need to be, you know, considered within the context that we're looking at in terms of these substantial modernization bills that do need to be addressed. Absolutely, we should be thinking about climate change, I suppose, in terms of, you know, military installations, fuel efficiency, et cetera. And I assume that they will be, but the increases that we saw, I think, within the top line were not nearly substantial enough to address any of this, right? You're not approaching the 3-5% real growth or anywhere near it. And so, Mackenzie, I welcome you weighing in here on your thoughts on this, but that's my two cents on the short term, at least.
Mackenzie?
Yeah, these problems don't age well, right? That's the challenge. I mean, most problems don't, but in this particular case, right, the hot potato has landed in Secretary Austin and Secretary Hicks's lap. The music has stopped. The chairs are like, what other metaphor could I possibly use, right? to get, so, like, they got stuck holding the hot potato and now they have to figure it out, right? And I do get a little concerned, not with Secretary Austin as secretary, but with his previous role as combatant commander, to my point earlier. But that doesn't mean, you know, he hasn't seen growth. And, you know, now that he has an enterprise-wide view that he can't look at things differently, I'm sure he can. But right, so the problems don't age well. What we've seen are the services, you know, just put Band-Aids on top of duct tape in the equivalent of their solutions, particularly with sort of extending service lives or just modest, you know, incremental upgrades, when now it's time to either just stop that, make the leap, or use your legacy platform, some of them, as, you know, technology playgrounds, since the Pentagon's no longer an inventor. So, you know, on most things, they're going to have to innovate with commercially available technology, something they're not used to doing. And you can see that manifest in the kinds of comments that come out of the building, and even the operational concepts and the ways service leaders talk about them. You know, they want to have this vision for warfare and have Silicon Valley bring them those technologies. And that just shows a lack of awareness fundamentally about how this is going to get done, which is the service chiefs have to go to Silicon Valley and say, what do you have? And then they got to go write a concept around that, right? So there's a fundamental turning of the telescope that also needs to happen. I think I've over-metaphored my morning. I'm all done now.
they were terrific metaphors, Mackenzie, as always. Mackenzie, let me aim this at you. I can't help but look at the Afghanistan withdrawal decision as sort of almost a parable for muddled thinking. And it's not necessarily the problem we have is technological. Isn't it sort of muddled thinking that we have an inability to prioritize, an inability to look at what we really need, as opposed to contriving sort of stories about what we need that we may not need, right? I mean, it just doesn't seem to me that we're approaching this, you know, as we would have in the Cold War. And I will say there was a lot of muddled thinking in the Cold War as well. But I mean, right, things sort of made sense that we did them. And now there's too much of what we do that just makes no sense at all. Is that the problem? And do you see clarity of thinking sneaking into the calculus, whether in the department, among uniforms, civilian, or up on the Hill?
I mean, I'm not a cynic at all, but the muddle through is what Washington does best. And I mean each entity here, right? Like the department, like Capitol Hill, like the combatant commanders. And, you know, they've all come of age adjusting each year to the muddle through, right? Just for example, continuing resolutions, right? There's an expectation built into the system that there will be one every year, even if we have regular order, there's no reason to expect that. And, you know, all of the sort of repercussions and bad spending behavior that follows because of the expectations of the political game in town, right? And then of course the uncertainty, a lot of this was Budget Control Act and sequestration. Will it happen? Won't it? In 3 years of that hair pulling, right? So the muddle through is unfortunately what the system has, you know, thinking is what they know how to do best, and it's what they'll be rewarded for doing, as opposed to, you know, I was picking on Robert Gates earlier. At the same time, it takes a leader like that, a bully like Rumsfeld and Gates, like, to get some of this done. Congress can be convinced. They will roll over if they think that you're smarter than they are, that you've thought about it longer and harder. That everyone's in it together and they can jump off the cliff, you know, like, yeah, it's going to hurt my district a little bit, but it's hurting, you know, that guy's too and hers too. And, you know, it's for the good of the country. It's to save the military, you know, no fair fight, the kind of stuff that Biden has talked about. But I am worried because the muddle through is easier. At the end of the day, it's just politically easier to just scrape by each year and hope that, you know, next year will be the year that you prevail. And then in the meantime, right, the leaders turn over, particularly at DOD, whether that's the chiefs or the appointees. And that just makes it all even more difficult. So it requires leadership and courage. There's no doubt about it. And that's pretty hard to come by these days.
Well, I mean, the clarity of thinking is the thing that I think is most important, to be able to, you know, instead of using all of the effort to sort of justify things that may not really make sense under the guise that they're vital, as opposed to looking at stuff clearly and saying, here are the five things we need, and here's how we get those five things and what we don't need anymore. And that to me is, I see glimpses of people thinking, but the concern is that everybody just sort of goes back to their default positions. And I think you're absolutely right, right? It takes a Gates, you know, who was backed by his president, by the way, right? I mean, Barack Obama backed the cuts that were being made. And so it made it hard for people. Oh, well, we're going to appeal this decision to the White House. We're going to appeal it to Congress. And it appears that, you know, that means hard work an administration has to do, where those, for example, on the contracting side of things, recognize that they may not be able to prevail. So,
yeah, I love your point on clarity of thinking. I'm sorry I failed to address that. Yes, I do agree with you. And I also agree with your characterization of where everyone is. I see glimpses of it, right? So like even the Commandant's guidance, you might disagree with a lot of it, but there were glimpses of brilliance in there of trying to really tackle the problem in a new way, the challenge that we're confronted with by China in particular. I see some of this in the way, again, General Brown is thinking and talking in, you know, Accelerate Change or Lose and other guidance documents that he's talked about, but it's right. It's glimpses. I'm going to give the team a little bit of time to, before I, you know, Hallie and I come back and give you our grade for this fiscal year and how they're really doing. Cause there isn't much time, but I'll give them another, you know, half year or so.
Terrific. Guys, thanks so much for joining us. Really appreciate it. Always, Mackenzie, always a pleasure having you on. And Hallie, look forward to welcoming you on many more times again in the future. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Vago. Thanks, Hallie.
Thank you.